So, Catherine, tell me how you became interested in ceramics in the first place. I'm going to guess Mom has something to do with this.
You would be amazed to find out that she does not, in spite of the fact that we are both potters. I actually got her interested in ceramics.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, I started getting pretty serious about taking ceramics classes when I was around middle school age. Prior to that, every artist always says, "Oh, I've been doing art for forever, for as long as I can remember." Well, I'd always been drawing. I think I always figured that I would be one of those people that illustrated the science textbooks. I was always drawing, animals,
Biological type of
wildlife. Yeah,
drawings. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
very precise.
But so I fell in love with ceramics, and by around maybe middle of high school, I had pretty much decided I'm going to be a potter. And it took me at least another decade after that to start actually bringing in some of the illustration that I was doing as a kid into my ceramics practice instead of, just making beautiful glazed pottery. And I'd start painting on them and turning them into sculptures instead.
Well, I see the link with what you're saying. When I look at your pottery, there's a lot of, I think online you described it as wild and domestic flora and fauna, which shows that biological drawing interest.
I drew a lot of inspiration from old Audubon prints and old Japanese woodblock prints, Chinese ink wash paintings where they were doing, those intimate little studies of, just a little insect on a cherry blossom branch, something like that. And I've brought a lot of that influence into my painting style.
Other than just loving nature, is there a connection with sustainability, ecological issues? You're interested in sustainability?
I really am. I tend to practice a little bit of sustainability as much as I can in my own home. And in my own behaviors. And I don't always actually start out a concept thinking, okay, this is that. I'll pick one little subject. Like right now, I'm working on these sculptural chalices with salamanders. So I picked a real specific little salamander and I started doing research on this little salamander and thinking about how I wanted this chalice to look. The way I was constructing the chalices, they reference the landscape. So I was looking for what does the salamander eat? Where does it live? And I'm referencing on the chalices, the leaves from some of the flora that comes into its habitat. And I found out, oh, this salamander species is a really particular niche creature that really only inhabits this one certain type of pond. It's a type of pond that appears and disappears throughout the year in woodlands. And that's an unusual thing. You don't usually have a pond in woodlands. It's going to be in a clearing. So this little guy, if you know your amphibians, you can really narrow in on what it is. And everything in this chalice starts to fit in with him perfectly. And I didn't necessarily plan right from the start. This is what it's going to be, but it evolved into that by the end.
And as someone who started with drawing, do you first draw something or do you go right to the clay?
I have done enough of them at this point that for a lot of the cases, I can just go right into the clay. If it's a species that I'm less familiar with, I will do a series of just really messy sketches, just on scrap paper usually. I hardly keep a sketchbook anymore. But I can, for a lot of these things, just go straight into the clay process.
So talk a little bit about some of these contributions you've had in Art Prize, the Pond Life series, landscape vessels, and talk about the techniques you use, the type of kiln, which I understand is kind of unique.
It is. So a lot of my, as far as my techniques go, I do a lot of vessels that are thrown and altered, or I use hand building techniques in my thrown vessels. So I make a base on the pot. Think of it as a sketch, or not on the pot, but on the potter's wheel. Think of it as a sketch. So I'll make a very messy sort of outline of what the basic form of the creature is going to be. And then I'll take that vessel and I'll chop it up into bits, cut into it, add to it, stretch it, pinch it, start to turn it into something that more closely resembles an animal than a vase, say, and add like all of the little details as things get refined. So it's very, very much like refining a sketch process. And the way I fire these, it is a special kiln. It's a wood-fired kiln. And wood-fired kilns are a type of kiln that you need to have a community to be able to fire for the most part. Some small ones, a single potter may be able to fire by themselves, but when you think about you have to be able to tend that fire for 24 hours as long as that kiln's firing, and most wood fire kilns are going to fire for more than one day, it becomes a little bit of a challenge if you're a single person.
So does somebody have to constantly tend to that?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just walk away.
No, because you might be putting wood in every 5 minutes. You might be putting wood in every hour at some points. But
Wow. But
you have to be there kind of watching the kiln to see what state of the firing it's at and be prepared to put wood in it.
So you have like a team of potters who and you kind of trade off?
Yes, you do. We just take shifts like, you know, regular old shift work, but regular old shift work sitting at the bonfire and putting wood in it. The gigantic bonfire. It's a 2,400 degree fire at the front of the kiln.
What's the kiln built out of?
Bricks. Really high temperature bricks. So you might not encounter these at, you know, Lowe's or Menards, your local hardware store.
I guess not. So what drew you to this kind of a kiln versus other kinds that maybe are a little easier on your clock?
A few things. It became really an addictive process almost instantly for me. It was a thing that I did at once, and I immediately fell in love. I fell in love with the community of the wood kiln. I fell in love with the process of tending the kiln. It's a really satisfying thing by the end of it, by the time you've, you know, chopped all the cords of wood that you're going to burn in the kiln and, you know, spent hours adding the wood to the fire and tending the fire. You have a real feeling of satisfaction at the end. And it brings colors to my pots that are unique to this firing process that you can't duplicate in any other type of kiln. It's a kiln where you don't have to glaze your pots. So I get these really beautiful warm browns and oranges and flashes of red and bleached out white streaks on my pots that really create an atmosphere. I get In one of my painted landscapes, it often looks like sun filtering through trees, or I've had some that look like a misty field with sheep in them. And these are all things that I can predict a little bit are going to happen, but it's like I can predict one of these results will happen, and it'll be a great result out of 20 possibilities.
So there's always that surprise factor. You don't know what the fire is going to do.
Always a surprise, and it always adds to the painting that I do rather than have it just be a simple, I put these pigments on here and I put a clear glaze over it and this is what you get. Nothing else is added to it. I guess, you know, I'm going to go back to painting analogies. It's a lot like adding ink washes over things, washes of color over things, and losing a little bit of that predictability and control. And I really like balancing, having a very, very controlled, you know, painting process or sculpture process with adding in the unpredictability of some other source like the wood in the kiln, or I make my forms in a lot of different ways that will throw a little bit of, well, that's an interesting twist there to that thing that could otherwise just be a perfect square. And it's just how I handle the clay that'll make it move a little bit.
So in other words, you might make one pot and the other and seemingly use the same process, the same whatever techniques, and put it into that kiln, and they're going to come out quite different?
Yes, indeed. Totally different.
Fascinating.
Sometimes.
Fascinating.
One of my favorite things to do is take two pots that I did exactly the same and say, these do not look anything alike, do they? But they are done totally the same. All
truly
the same glazes,
piece.
All the same pigments.
So where are these kilns located?
They're a little bit difficult to find. There are a good amount of wood fire potters throughout the country. We have a few major kilns in Michigan. And a lot of times individual potters will build their own kilns on their property and invite in other people to fire with them. And actually, a friend of mine, Dawn Soltysiak, who you had on an interview recently.
Love Dawn.
Yes. We just built a new wood kiln on her property last fall, and we've gone through two firings so far this year. We're really happy to have this little resource available. We've been inviting in other potters that we know and think would benefit from this kiln to join us.
She's got wonderful work there of not just her own, but many, many artists. So we could find your work at her studio, Fernwood 1891.
Yes, you could.
But you're also at Park Trades?
I'm also at Park Trades. I have a studio group that we rent a space together at Park Trades, Kalamazoo Artisans.
I was going to ask you about that because I understand you're not only president, but a founding member. So tell us, what is Kalamazoo Artisans?
We're a group that started out because some things were getting downsized out of other available programs in the area. And there was a group of potters who wanted to still have a community studio available, and they wanted to be able to work in the way they wanted to work, not be limited by what some of the institutions in the area were offering. So we started looking around at what was available. I was returning from graduate school at the time and needing a larger space than what I had at home to be able to do some of the production parts of my work. So I joined up with them, and we picked Park Trades Center to base our studio out of, and we pooled our resources and purchased some of the larger equipment that it's more difficult for an individual artist who's maybe not trying to do this professionally, maybe just wants to be able to have access to the equipment. So we have almost everything you would want in a major studio, from hand building equipment to a spray booth to apply glazes and other pigments to several wheels and several electric kilns. About the only things that we're limited in right now, and I intend to take that away as I'm able to build my own home studio bigger, is we don't have access to a gas kiln or a raku kiln or some of the other atmospheric firing techniques that I've been traveling around to participate in. But as I, mature as an adult and am able to build some of these things, I have always intended to make them available to our group at my own home.
So how many potters are in this Kalamazoo Artisans group? How big of a group is this?
Right now, we have, I think, 9 members.
That's pretty good for a studio.
It's a pretty good size. And we would probably be able to take more because some of us use the studio less than others. And we've always...
So you kind of sign up for your time to use...
Not really. It hasn't been an issue yet. If it ever becomes an issue, we can do that. But we haven't had a problem with maneuvering around each other's schedule. And, with only 9 people, actually, that's not so many that you're likely to get more than a couple people in the studio at a time. So
let's talk about your mom. Instead of usually the generations, the older generation teaches the young generation, you said you drew your mom into this. How did that happen?
So it happened when I was,
We should mention her name.
Yeah, my mom. So my mom is Jackie Stasevich, and she's also a member of Kalamazoo Artisans with me. And we do similar work in a way in that we are both very nature themed, but we work at totally different temperatures in totally different color spectrums. And while I tend to be a little bit more naturalistic, like Audubon Prince naturalism, she has gone a little bit more, I would say, Art Nouveau and Art Deco in her decorative techniques. So it's really interesting with it, you know, working together out of the same space.
Do you ever show your work together? Or?
We do sometimes. Every now and then we'll do little art fairs together. She doesn't do very many art fairs. She's retired and likes to keep this as a fun thing to do. She's very prolific anyway, and also represented by Dawn Soltysiak.
Bless Dawn. She is home to so many local artists. She does great, great work in that.
She is a fantastic resource for the arts community in West Michigan. I'm also fairly active about posting what I'm making in my studio at the time on Facebook, just under Catherine Stasevich Studio. And a lot of times people will just say, I see what you're making there and I really like it. Can I buy it? Before it's even fired. So a lot of times things will sell on there, and I'm very happy to do that.
So you post things in process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So people can see problems am I going through. But we're also going to be participating at my parents' home in Richland in Arts and Eats this coming October. I believe it's the third weekend in October, Saturday and Sunday. And I will be running a show with Kalamazoo Valley Potters hosting it. It's the Art Etc. show and sale in November, the Saturday before Thanksgiving. That is going to be at Second Reformed Church right on Stadium in Howard.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Catherine, and thank you for your beautiful work.
Thank you.